Coming up on Weekend America.
To Californians, Proposition 8 is more than just words on a ballot.
So it's been a battle internally here going, I have friends, I don't want to discriminate against them, but do I actually believe this? What I go to church for every week?
What an amendment against same-sex marriage means to how supporters and opponents live their lives. I'm John Moe. In St. Louis, it's a vote on public transit that will make a big difference.
It's the ability to get to your job, to get to medical appointments, to participate in community life without having to rely on other people.
Also this hour, that loser candy at the bottom of the plastic pumpkin can still come in handy as a mole sauce for seafood, for instance.
This is really just wine, a little vinegar, and I threw in some Smarties and some suckers.
So is that a treat or a trick? Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Had the weirdest thing happen last night. We're out trick-or-treating, and after a while, my son, who's almost 8, and my daughter, who's 6, they say, Dad, let's go home. We have enough candy. They voluntarily stopped. Crazy, huh? And spooky. This hour, we'll hear about a black market leftover candy scheme that couldn't fail, which then failed, and Lynn Rosetto Casper from The Splendid Table joins us to offer cooking tips for those leftover sweets, some involving white wine and goat cheese. What's the last piece of candy you have left after Halloween?
Oh, the very last candy that would stay in my bucket as a kid that I would not eat would be those little jellied fruit chews.
The last candy I want to eat is candy corns. They're gross.
The last candy that I would eat is Mike and Ike's.
I love to save my favorite for last, so usually that ends up being like the Reese's.
I'm not as fond of the hard candy, so I eat everything else first. Chocolate goes first.
Even though I love nuts and chocolate, I don't really like Baby Ruth's.
Smarties. They last forever.
Those voices came from Ann Arbor, St. Paul, and Concord, New Hampshire. Well, the presidential race has weighed heavily on many people's minds as Tuesday approaches, but it is not going to be the only thing on the ballot, of course. So we're going to leave Obama and McCain aside for a moment and talk about some other items people will be voting on. First, California, where Proposition 8 would ban same-sex marriage by amending the state constitution. It's in response to a Supreme Court decision there that legalized same-sex marriage a few months ago. The outcome of Prop 8 could affect whether other states allow gay marriage, and the race there has gotten close and expensive and ugly. Accusations of intolerance and vandalism are flying on both sides. But some people are trying to stay above the fray, even though they have strong feelings about the measure. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark introduces us to a few.
Steve Weir and John Hem got married on a soggy morning last summer, June 17th, the first day same-sex marriage was legal in California.
And we're still waiting to have our honeymoon. That's going to come in December. And I'm hoping that we're still legally married when we go.
John and Steve have been together for 18 years, and they pledged their lives to each other long before the state of California made it official. Still, John says being married feels different.
I feel actually a little bit more part of normal society. You're part of that brick in the house that's called life. You're not just a rock out in the yard. You're married.
And at least until the results of Prop 8 are tallied, they've got the marriage license to prove it.
That's me, Party A.
That's me,
Party B.
But if you look closely at the form, you notice something about Steve's signature.
Do I see your signature here twice?
Yeah, I had to sign this as the person seeking to get married, and then that's my signature that is digitally put on certified copies. So it's kind of funny. Look, it even kind of matches.
You see, Steve Weir is actually in charge of issuing marriage licenses, including his own, in the county where he lives, Contra Costa. He's the county clerk here, so he's also in charge of running elections, including this one, the one with Prop 8 on the ballot.
This is a tally machine. It is the ESNS 650. And it's a high-speed scanner that can scan up to 19-inch ballots.
Steve takes me to an observation room to show me the tally machines through the glass.
And then it shoots into that tray.
His office has already started to process the ballots that will determine whether his marriage will remain legal. It's a strange position to be in. He'll privately cast his own vote, But he says his deepest commitment during this election is to other voters.
Regardless of what my opinion is about the way the world ought to work, we're going to do the right thing in counting people's votes as part of our democratic process.
One of the votes that Steve Weir's office will count is Ron Barker's.
So you want me to read this? It says, while trying to evaluate Proposition 8, making marriage between a man and a woman part of California's Constitution.
Ron lives with his wife and their four daughters in Contra Costa County. He teaches Sunday school at their church. He says he's usually pretty apolitical, but he just wrote his first ever letter to the editor in support of Prop 8.
And then my name, Ron Barker from Danville, California.
Against gay marriage.
I don't know why. It just seems to cheapen the term marriage to me. If you didn't call it marriage, if you said, hey, we're going to have civil unions and it's going to be all the same benefits, but we're going to call it a civil union, I'd be fine with that.
Ron says his feelings about Prop 8 come from his understanding of several passages in the Bible.
The man should not lie with man and things like that. When you start talking like that, that's where I get sensitive because I go, then you start sounding like a religious nut. I'm comfortable that the Bible teaches that, but I don't think it ever teaches you to discriminate. So it's been a battle internally here going, I have friends. I don't want to discriminate against them, but do I actually believe this, what I go to church for every week?
At the same time, he's watched Prop 8 turn people against each other, and he doesn't like it.
We have neighbors right around the corner here who have prominently put their Yes on 8 sign out and who have been great friends with their next-door neighbors, and they are no longer speaking. And they're next-door neighbors to each other. We have other friends who have put signs up in their yard and have had vandalism done to their house on both sides. So stuff like that just saddens me.
And even though he's opposed to gay marriage, Ron says mostly he just can't wait for the ugliness of this election to be over.
To not have to listen to either side anymore, get hammered over the head every day, see the signs up, see the fighting that's going on. So I will feel relief more than I will feel happiness or sadness, whether it passes or fails.
That's true for Steve Weir, the county clerk, and his partner John, too. On Tuesday night, once the polls close and Steve's office has published the preliminary results, he'll print out the vote tallies, he'll go home, and he'll do what he always does after an election, no matter what the issue is.
I sit at the countertop. I hope I have a glass of wine.
He stands there and he just kind of rocks back and forth, like he did when he was 5 years old.
And I'm not looking to see, is something winning or losing?
He's looking to see if the tallies look accurate, if there are any close contests that might need a recount. He says first he wants to know that the election has been fair. Then he'll worry about which side won. In Contra Costa County, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Well, from California now to St. Louis, where public transit advocates are spending this weekend trying to sell voters on Proposition M. It would increase sales taxes by half a cent, about $55 per family per year, in order to ease a budget crunch. If this one doesn't pass, officials say they'll have to slash services, specifically public transit. According to the American Public Transit Association, about a third of the country's transit agencies say they'll need to cut services to balance their budgets. In our second collaboration with the PBS television project Blueprint America, reporter Rick Carr went to St. Louis to visit people who are likely to suffer the most if transit officials end up making cuts.
Nobody really likes buses. It's just that some people have no choice.
I catch the bus every day, Monday through Friday.
Willie Kimbrough has no choice because he uses a wheelchair, so it's tough to navigate long distances on city sidewalks. As he's leaving his job at a disabled rights organization for the night, he and a couple of colleagues, one who's vision impaired and another in a wheelchair, head to a bus stop. They've all got plenty of criticisms of public transit. Take the bus stop across the road. It's blocked by a trash can and the sidewalk's narrow. So when you roll off the wheelchair lift, you're likely to end up in a patch of grass. Stuck.
And so a lot of times the bus drivers will let them off in the street because it's actually more accessible. Not safe, but more accessible.
Then there's the waiting and the weather. There's no shelter at either stop, so with temperatures in the 40s and a stiff wind, the half hour between buses can seem like a very long time. After nearly 20 minutes, the number 59 appears in the distance.
Yeah, there it is, right there. Our bus is on its way.
But Kimbrough's in for another annoyance. There are only two spots for wheelchairs, and one's already occupied. So he lets his colleague roll onto the lift. Then the driver checks with his dispatcher to find out how long Kimbrough's going to have to wait.
They're coming this way at about 5:42.
That's nearly another half hour in the cold.
All right.
I stay with Kimbrough's colleagues on the bus as it pulls away, and through the window, I see him zip his jacket a little tighter. Disabled activists say they'd love to see better bus service in St. Louis. Greater frequency, more space for wheelchairs, better bus stops. But unless voters actually decide to raise their own taxes by voting for Proposition M, they'll have to deal with worse service. Transit officials say a lot of cities are facing the same crisis, stemming from the same causes. First, the monthly cost of fuel for all those buses has quadrupled. Then there's the Wall Street crisis. Bob Baer, who runs the St. Louis system, says during the boom, transit agencies tried to improve their cash flow by investing in some exotic financial instruments.
We have swaps. We have treasury strips. We have sale-leaseback programs. We deferred bond payments.
Those were great until the economy tanked. Now they cost money. Finally, there's federal law, which specifies exactly how transit agencies have to make cuts.
We can't just cut buses or trains or call a ride. You have to do it equitably. So in effect, all the service we provide are going to get hit. The handicapped, the elderly are going to get hit.
Disabled activists worry most about cuts to that call-a-ride service, a network of vans that carry disabled riders who live too far away from a regular bus or train stop. Sarah Coyle, for example, who sat in her wheelchair in chilly pre-dawn darkness waiting for the van that takes her to work.
Usually they come by 7:30.
Coyle lives with her parents in a leafy suburb more than a mile from the nearest bus stop, in a subdivision with no sidewalks. She worries about how she'll deal with a service cut.
I'm going to have to rely on my family, and I'm very concerned about it because my parents are getting older, and it's going to be harder. It's going to be harder on them and on me.
For her, transit means the difference between utter dependence on others and a sense of freedom.
It's the ability to get to your job, to get to medical appointments, to participate in community life without having to rely on other people. The chance to be able to just go down the street, whether you walk, whether you use a wheelchair or a motorized scooter, and hop on the bus and get to where you need to go.
A few minutes later, the call-a-ride van pulls up and Coyle rolls onto its lift.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
There's a button pinned to the back of her chair. It reads, "Vote yes on Proposition M." As the van trundles off into the twilight, taking her to work, she says she hopes her neighbors are willing to pay a few extra dollars more in taxes so that she can get around on her own. In St. Louis, I'm Rick Carr for Weekend America and Blueprint America.
Rick Carr's story is part of the Blueprint America series from Channel 13 WNET in New York City and made possible by support from the Rockefeller Foundation. For more on the project, go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
"18 years old and out on their own. But do kids raised in foster care have the skills to make it as adults? Coming up on Weekend America. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. Today in Los Angeles, over 700 people are gathered for the It's My Life conference held by the Seattle-based Casey Family Programs. The conference connects kids about to age out of foster care with programs and mentors that can help them gain independence. Each year, 26,000 American teenagers in foster care leave their foster families or group homes and try to make it on their own. In most states, this happens when they turn 18. It's tough to make it, though, without family support. Foster kids who age out at 18 are more likely than their peers to be unemployed, poor, or homeless. Ellen Gettler is a producer with American Radio Works. She spent 2 years following one young woman in St. Paul after she aged out of foster care. We're going to talk with Ellen in a minute, but first we'll hear the story, which begins in the spring of 2005.
Tyandra Newton walks up the steps of a small stone building. Her friend Jama Bowar trails behind.
Just go?
Yeah, just jump over.
Halfway up, they hoist themselves onto the staircase wall, throw their legs over, and land on a flat, black tarred roof.
We had our blanket, our clothes and stuff.
Tyandra says it's the roof where she and Jama slept when they had nowhere else to go.
But, like, she was scared, so I slept in the front so nobody could see her.
Tyandra's 19. Her round cheeks are marked by deep dimples when she smiles. Her eyes often glance downward, shyly. On her neck, her nickname Ty is tattooed in curly script. Ty went into foster care when she was a baby. Her mother was addicted to drugs. Ty lived in so many foster homes and institutions, she lost count. When she aged out at 18, Ty walked out of her foster home and into a homeless shelter. She stayed in shelters for the first year on her own, and in one of them she met Jama. The two girls, with no one else, clung to each other. Ty says she was with Jama the night their options ran out.
One night, we had absolutely nowhere to go. We, like, called around. We called almost every shelter. The shelters, they were all full for our ages. I knew it was getting dark, and I knew I didn't have no place to stay.
Ty remembered this low-roofed building. It overlooked the park she played in as a child. And so they climbed up here to sleep. It was hot and dark, and they were scared to be caught trespassing and scared of the men who walked through the park.
It felt like I hit rock bottom. Like, when I was little, I used to see, like, people sleeping on the streets, and I never understood because I just didn't understand. I mean, when I used to stay in shelters, I knew I was homeless, but when I had to sleep outside, I just knew, like, my life is over. I was a nobody.
Ty's story is not uncommon among foster kids who age out at 18. One out of seven of them will become homeless by the time they're 20. Ty has some family. Her two older sisters also grew up in foster care. Ty wishes she could depend on them, but they haven't fared much better than she has, so she continues to go it alone.
This is it.
After a year in and out of shelters, Ty finally finds a place to live. Her new home is in an apartment building called Seventh Landing. It's permanent housing for young people who have been homeless.
That's the bathroom. That's the hallway.
It's just a single room with a bathroom, but she's delighted to have her own place.
I have my own apartment.
And she's working three part-time jobs. Seventh Landing will help Ty enroll in school. She wants to become a full-time registered nurse and plans to start classes in the fall. Now that her life is a little more stable, Ty's first priority is to help her family. Her sisters live nearby. She gives them money for groceries and takes care of their kids when they have to work.
Even though they weren't there for me when I needed them, I was there for them when they needed me. When I was growing up, I always felt like I was the one at the bottom. But now I feel like I'm the one at the top. I'm the one they call when they need something.
Ty longs to be with her family. She spent her childhood alone. She pays special attention to the kids because she remembers what it was like growing up with no one to dote on her. It's the summer of 2006. Ty's been living at Seventh Landing for 8 months. I find her playing with a little boy named Miguel. He's the child of a cousin, and he's been with Ty for days. Miguel's parents aren't taking care of him, but Ty can't bear to have him go to foster care.
I'm not saying that all foster homes are bad, but all the ones that I've been to have been. And if Miguel stays there, I'm just afraid of anyone going to foster care.
But Ty doesn't know how long she'll be able to take care of him. The rules at Seventh Landing say she has to live alone, so Miguel can't move in with her.
Somewhere down the road, I am going to raise my family a totally different way, the way my family was raised. I just want us all to be a family. I just want us all to be together.
So Ty makes a risky decision. She decides to leave Seventh Landing and the support it offers so she can find an apartment where she and Miguel can be together. But a year later, it's winter of 2007, and things aren't going well. Tai's not in school. Instead, she finds a job at a college cafeteria, but she doesn't have work when the school goes on break. Tai is still close to her sisters, and she takes care of Miguel. She loves being with them. But they can't give her what most parents give their children, someone to fall back on when things go wrong. Tai is still on her own.
Ellen Gettler from American Radio Works is with us now. Hello, Ellen.
Hello.
So that was 2007. What's happened to Tai since then?
We have not been able to locate Tai. The phone number I had for her doesn't work, and she has changed addresses since we last talked with her. You know, throughout the reporting, this would actually happen fairly frequently, that her cell phone would run out of minutes and her phone number would change. She moved once, in fact. And so she would sort of go missing, and then she would check back in with me and we'd be able to pick up the story where we left off. I was able to get in touch with one of the people who used to work with Tai when Tai lived at Seventh Landing. She said that Tai did have work and she had a place to live and she seemed to be quite happy.
How common is that for people in Tai's situation to kind of fall off the grid like that?
It's not at all uncommon. You know, imagine yourself at 18. Were you ready to pay rent? Were you ready to finance your own education, be successful in the job market? We rely on our families not only at ages 18, 19, but into adulthood and throughout our lives. So these are kids who, once they age out at 18, it's not uncommon for them to face great challenges and to not do very well.
So what's being done to address this situation for people aging out of foster care?
Many say that foster care should be extended beyond the age of 18, that essentially when a child is taken out of his or her home, the child becomes a ward of the state, and the state is the child's parent. And parents don't often throw their kids out on the street at age 18. That's difficult because once a child is an adult, the child may not choose to remain in care. Another solution is to offer young people life skills training and to pair them with mentors, teach them how to balance a checkbook, deal with a landlord, offer them assistance applying for school or for a job. Many would say that this is a woefully inadequate solution, that children really need a community of stable, loving adults for both financial and emotional support into adulthood. And finally, there's a growing movement to adopt, particularly teenagers, out of the foster care system. Typically, it's been difficult to convince families to adopt teenagers. These are kids who often have some problems. But many say that this is the only way that kids can make that transition into adulthood, to have a stable, permanent community of adults throughout their entire lives.
Ellen Gettler from American Radio Works, thanks.
Thanks so much.
You can find that American Radio Works documentary about aging out of foster care at our website. You can also see some pictures of Tai and a picture of Miguel as well. While you're there, let us know what you think should be done about this issue. WeekendAmerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
Halloween is over and you're stuck with leftover loser candy. Why not prepare a sweet and sour mole sauce with Smarties? Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Election Day is Tuesday, as you know, but early voting has been going on in some states for a while now. You can vote today in North Carolina. More than a million voters in Florida have already cast ballots, and this week saw long lines at early voting centers. The governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, actually extended early voting due to the heavy demand. It's a big, big year for turnout in America. Today, we're finishing up our series, Conversations with America, various takes on what voters should have on their minds when they cast their ballots. Writer Julia Alvarez says voting is an intense experience for her, one she wishes she could share more widely.
Every election day, when I get to vote, I cry. I do. I see people I know and people I don't know, old people, young people, parking their cars to claim their one vote, people who disagree with me and people who agree with me. But mostly, I see ghosts, people who made this happen for me. You see, I'm remembering. I'm remembering people from the Dominican Republic, the country we fled in 1960. I'm remembering those who could not leave the dictatorship, the tios and tias, uncles and aunts, who wanted me to have this day. Some were freedom fighters who died trying to win this right for me. Some were just scared, everyday people who lived without ever having had this day for themselves. I owe them my thanks, and I thank them by voting. On this day, I get to say what kind of a world I want. I know the price tag of being able to have this right. When I hear people say they're not going to vote, that it won't make a difference, I think, give it to me. I'll recycle it. I know a bunch of people who can use it. I'll send it to Piti, a Haitian worker in the mountains of the Dominican Republic, who dreams of someday studying in this country. Or to Mari, who takes care of my mommy and papi back in their homeland and asks me to bring her to the United States every time I visit. Or I'll send it just down the road, right here in Vermont, to Felipe, or Thelma, or Roberto, Mexican migrant workers who are helping our local Vermont farmers stay on their farms. Workers whose own children were born here. Children who will one day be able to say what kind of a world they want because their parents thought of them. I want everyone who can vote to vote. And as they do, I want them to remember that someone back then thought of us. I want us to vote not just for ourselves, but for the children of the future, American or not. The first settlers of this continent believed that the earth is not given to us by our parents, it is loaned to us by our children. I want us to think about that debt and vote for the candidate who best remembers that promise and that promissory note. What we owe the children of the future, a green, viable, livable earth, a human family at peace, solving our problems together. Relatives and friends in the Dominican Republic died so I could have this day. 48 years later, in Weybridge, Vermont, a citizen of a whole other country, I get to vote because they thought of me. Now it's my turn. I'll vote thinking of children whose names I don't know and whose nationalities don't matter, but who deserve a future we have to start paying back to them. Someday it will make a difference that we thought of them today.
Julia Alvarez is the author of How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents and In the Time of Butterflies. She's also published several books of poetry and books for children. To hear more from our Conversations with America series, go to weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. All right, it's November. Now, trick-or-treating is over, and you are left with some candy, depending on how greedy the kids are, how many people showed up at your house. Don't know how much candy you have, but you have some. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we asked you for suggestions of what to do with the sugar injection, and a number of you wrote in to tell us about how your parents used to check your candy, you know, when you had to dump your loot out on the table after you got back, and mom and dad said that they just wanted to see if there was anything dangerous in there, but, you know, you still somehow found yourself short a few Kit Kats by the time they were done. Darcella Craven wrote to tell us how the candy was dealt with in her St. Louis neighborhood when she was a kid.
The older kids would take the younger kids, and usually we'd divide ourselves into about two or three groups, and we'd go around that neighborhood and trick-or-treat. Basically, it was the older kids' job to ensure that the younger kids knew all the really bad jokes and got enough candy and weren't terrified to walk up on the porch. And at the end, we'd all gather together, usually on this guy named Alan's front porch because he was usually the oldest kid that was with us. And you'd dump all your stuff out in front of you, and then you'd start doing what I like to call a candy stock market. You start trading, you know, your mini stickers for your Go Daddies and your gummy bears and, you know, whatever they have had at the time, all trying to kind of get the best candy and get rid of what you didn't like. At the end of the night, everyone got their equal share because the big kids made sure that even if you didn't get your candy from knocking on the doors, you had to get somebody's candy. So you had to give them pretty much whatever they wanted. You try to negotiate, you know, for the lemon head, here, take this, or take those little horrible peppermint balls. But for the most part, they usually took as much or anything they wanted.
Wow. Some admirable entrepreneurship there in St. Louis. But sometimes bright ideas don't quite pan out. Johnny Vince Evans is an engineer here at our studios. The plan he hatched in junior high was perfect, foolproof, could not go wrong.
It wasn't even dark yet. We'd go out and we'd stay out until way past when all the other kids had to be home at like 9 o'clock. We'd come home like 10 or 10:30 and we'd just have these big, huge pillowcases just bursting with candy. Halloween night was great in our neighborhood because we lived in this pretty new neighborhood. There were hundreds of kids. This was 1981. I was in eighth grade and my mom kept this candy cupboard. We had a pretty much unlimited supply of like Snickers and Twix and Smarties. It wasn't like the one time of the year where you get to gorge on candy. We always got to gorge on candy. So I had this big pile of candy left over. I wasn't too excited about it, so I said, you know, what I should do is be like that guy on Sesame Street, you know, the, psst, hey, bud, want to buy a watch? Except I was going to do that with candy. Psst, hey, bud, want to buy some candy? I had this purple windbreaker, and I just scotch taped all of these little candy bars and lollipops and lifesavers. Like, it was weighted down, and it was making all these cellophane noises every time I moved, and I figured I'd charge, like, 25 cents or whatever I could get at school the next day. I didn't tell my parents about it. I didn't tell anybody about it. I was just going to really blow people away. I really wanted to show my best friend, but I kept his secret until I got to English class, and I flashed open my jacket just to kind of get a reaction. His eyes kind of bugged open, and then he like said, give me some. I was like, no, I'm selling it. So he told everybody else. He said, hey, Johnny's got candy in his jacket. Johnny's got candy. And all of a sudden, there are these hands trying to grab in under my jacket, and I'm like pulling my jacket really tight and kind of causes a disruption. The teacher's like, what's going on over there? All through class, they're like poking at my jacket, and I'm like, when I get out of this class, they're going to jump me. The bell rings. I get out of class and everybody's following behind me and chasing me. And as soon as we get in the hall, like, they're all like, come on, come on. And I'm like pulling my jacket tighter and tighter. My locker's like at the other end of this long hall. And I'm like, no, I'm selling it. I'm not giving it away. You guys can't have it. I'm selling it. And all of a sudden they just jumped me. There was just this pile and I'm really ticklish. So I was just getting smothered and they're all reaching in my jacket and I'm like crying because halfway because I'm being assaulted and halfway because they're tickling me to death. I could hear each piece of candy being like ripped, the tape ripping off my jacket, and finally the crowd backed off and everybody's laughing and going down the hallway and like opened up my candy. And this one kid, David Harris, he's kind of a bully. He kind of came up real close to me and he gave me this like sad face. I didn't get any candy. I had one piece of candy left. I just ripped it up and I gave it to him and I was like totally defeated.
Okay, so that's what not to do with leftover candy. Ouch. But you still have those sweets today in 2008. Now, what do you do with them? Good stuff? You eat it. Easy. But what about the loser candy? You know, Smarties, generic drugstore suckers, candy corn, Tootsie Rolls. Eating that stuff plain just tastes like defeat, like you lost a bet or something. So what do you do with it? Well, don't worry. We're here to help. Lynn Rosetta Casper is the host of American Public Media's The Splendid Table, and she's walked from her studio over to ours with tips on cooking with loser candy. Hi, Lynn.
Hello, John.
Candies are sweets, but many of these candies are gross. So what can we do to make them better?
Well, first of all, you should know that if you take a Tootsie Roll and you take Poppin' Fresh dough, you know, the rolls, right?
Sure.
And you stick a Tootsie Roll inside of that Poppin' Fresh before you bake it. You know the pain au chocolat? It's like a croissant, right, but it has chocolate in the middle. You can create that.
Pillsbury tube rolls and some Tootsie Rolls.
You got Tootsie Roll. That, this is absolutely. Now, following the Poppin' Fresh concept, there is the Jolly Rancher Sunday Biscuit. Now, this involves actually crushing the Jolly Rancher. And you use it in two ways. Half of it goes into the biscuit, that same idea, raw biscuit, stuff the center. But the other half gets sprinkled on the outside and it caramelizes as it bakes.
This is Sunday brunch.
This is Sunday brunch, without a doubt.
So those are our sweets. Those are ways to rechannel our candies into new sweets that are perhaps not more delicious, but more intriguing.
More intriguing, and I'd love to think more delicious as well.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, can we go beyond sweets? Can we get into the savories?
Now, this is where a great challenge comes along, but one cannot resist. There is a universally loved flavor combination that is sweet-sour, right? It's the first thing you go to in any cuisine. Well, what I discovered was, you know when you take a sauté pan and you cook a chicken breast in it or a piece of fish, and you get all those brown crusties, and you know, recipe books tell you to put a little broth, maybe a little wine. I made one, and I brought you. Now, this is really just wine, a little vinegar, and I threw in some Smarties and some suckers. I know it looks like heck because some Tootsie Roll got in there as well, but you don't have to do the Tootsie Roll.
Okay, I'm going to try this.
Try this now.
You know, oops, I'm dripping. It has the notes of candy in it.
Mm-hmm.
You can taste the candy,
right?
But you forgive the candy's presence. And you got a nice little sweet and sour sauce.
Now, you put that over a piece of grilled fish, and they will come, and they will eat it. Just don't tell them what it is. And now, my favorite is mini dinosaur eggs, which you can serve all through the holidays as hors d'oeuvre. And this is borrowed from a very famous caterer in New York. They used to take goat cheese, which they would pack around a grape. Well, we're not going to use a grape. We're going to use candy corn.
Ah.
And then you take Jolly Ranchers or lollies, you know, lollipops.
Sure.
Crush them because they're sparkly and, you know, they're crunchy. And you roll these little tiny sort of mini dinosaur eggs in that, and you get an experience the likes of which no one will have had at any time at any holiday party.
Well, it's kind of a moment of adulthood, isn't it? Because you have this sort of sentimental take you back to childhood candy corn, but look, I'm mature, I'm eating goat cheese.
Exactly. And by the way, the children can make these.
Right.
And it may introduce them to a wonderful cheese.
Now, can we transcend food entirely? Is there anything else we can do with it?
Yes. All you need is Elmer's glue and any surface you can imagine, okay? Because I think one of the things that's been seriously overlooked, and any five-year-old is going to tell you this, these are art project materials. Now, I mean, Christmas decorations, take any kind of torn-up cardboard, paint it on both sides, and then everybody in the family makes their own mosaic, so you can do suckers that stick out like a, you know, a sundial. You could do anything you want with the Tootsie Rolls. I mean, they could be standing up like little missiles. Mm-hmm. And then you can just put a hole in the cardboard and you hang it on the tree.
You can make Tootsie Rolls look attractive.
Yeah. In fact, if you do a Tootsie Roll on end, glued to the cardboard with two pieces of candy corn laid flat on top of it so they look like a, you know, they're going off in two different directions, you can actually receive messages from Mars.
Lynn Rosetta Casper from The Splendid Table. Thanks, Lynn.
It's been fun. Thank you, John.
Those recipes are at our website. Now, Lynn's great, but we know you have some good ideas, too. Let's have a recipe swap, you guys. Come on. Go to weekendamerica.org, find this story, and share your own tips for bottom-of-the-barrel candy cooking.
My candy is all sorted, but I can't bring it to school the day after Halloween. My costume was outrageous, but it won't fit me next year, the day after Halloween. The neighbors that I met at their doors last night.
As of today, the weather forecast calls for mostly sunny skies in many of the battleground states going into Election Day. Nature won't decide this one. It's up to you, voters. Here with some weekend weather and fun is Jeannie Yandel.
In our world, there are a few creatures that have achieved mythical status. Unicorns, dragons, and apparently trucks, at least according to Stamford, Connecticut. Touch a Truck pays homage to these beasts on four wheels. Sunny in 52 for personal time with tow trucks, tractor trucks, and monster trucks. Listen to the bards sing of days of old when trucks roamed the earth wild and free. Or, you know, just sit in an old fire truck. That's nice, too. Pigs are smart animals, hopefully smart enough to stay away from Shelby, North Carolina's hog happening. 68 and sunny for barbecue contests and all-you-can-eat pork. Exactly how is this happening for hogs? Wait, maybe the hogs are the people enjoying the all-you-can-eat portion of the festivities. Really brave pigs can enjoy the car shows, live music, and arts and crafts. What pig doesn't like a hand-crocheted tea cozy? You can't throw a rock without hitting a corn maze this time of year, but Zumbro Falls, Minnesota is so over corn mazes. They're going bigger, badder, and electricer with the world's only light maze. After the maze, try Nightlight Frisbee and Nightlight Mini Golf. Clear in 37, so bundle up before the Nightlight Wagon Ride. To cover the electric bill, tickets are $3,000. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Bands are used to playing different venues, nightclubs, state fairs, bar mitzvahs, but what are the challenges to playing a marathon? Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. New Yorkers will be carbo-loading tonight. The New York City Marathon is tomorrow. The race starts on Staten Island, goes through Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, the Bronx. The usual marathon trappings will all be there. T-shirts, first aid stations, those cups that people drink a little bit from all sloppy and then drop. I never really understood that. And there'll also be musical performers. Lots of them. String quartets, bagpipes, rockers, rappers, marching bands. You name it. And to leave it to New York to make running into something noisy. Ian Chillog will be among the 30,000 runners tomorrow. We asked him for his memories of past races, and he remembers the music and the, shall we say, lack of modesty.
out at the start, there's just all these really nervous people milling about, some of them trying to rest, some of them lying down. There's the world's longest urinal. It's like a long trough. I don't know, I'm going to guess 50 yards long with just men standing and having no shame. And then everyone's so well hydrated that they go out to the start and there are no porta-johns. And the smart guys, or at least the experienced guys who have done it before, have brought a bottle with them, which they tuck up their shorts and you can pee into that. And then you take the bottle out, you seal it up, and you hand it to the guy next to you, and you say, you always say, not water. It's like this great community. Everybody passes the bottles of urine down, and then the guy at the end tosses them over. They fire a cannon, and then I think it's New York, New York that they play. And then it's just like, you know, no matter where you are, you can't really run for the first half mile or so because there's so many people and everybody's so excited and people are cutting you off. And you're crossing the Verrazano Bridge and everybody likes to look over and the fireboats spray their water and it's like this beautiful thing. Around the 8 mile mark, as the race moves kind of out of Park Slope into Fort Greene, there's just a huge collection of people. You know, you just sort of hear it coming, and then you make this turn, and the crowds are just enormous. Then there's the Hasidic neighborhood in Brooklyn, where there are far fewer fans. There's not a lot of cheering there. But people are out and definitely watching. Actually, the first time I ran, that was, I think, the first really silent part of the course. Immediately out of there, you go into that the kind of hipster part of Brooklyn, and I remember that somebody had huge speakers out, and they were playing that Daft Punk song, One More Time. You know that song?
My name is Louis Maffei. I'm director of the arts at Bishop Lachlan Memorial High School. And we plan on doing what we've been doing for the last 31 years, which is performing the theme from the Rocky I movie. This started as a joke by our track coach, Ed Bose, who was one of the founding members of the Roadrunners Club. 31 years later, we are the original marathon band. We're still performing, although on that day we performed Rocky with about 10 band members. On Sunday, we'll be performing anywhere from 130 to even maybe even 160 band members, depending on how many alumni show up.
The most feared part of the New York course is the Queensboro Bridge, which is about mile 15. It's a hill to begin with, and there are no spectators allowed on the bridge. So you've had this music this whole time, and then it's gone. And it's like, oh, crap, I'm trying to run 26 miles. This was a horrible idea. Why am I doing this? All you hear is the shuffling of feet around you, and it's this very serious, very dark moment.
Hi, this is Will from the band Squirrels from Hell. We've been performing 30 years, and 20 years of that performing at the New York City Marathon at our regular spot on 1st Avenue and 113th Street. That is the 19th mile. Fists are in the air as they're running by, and it gives them the extra push to get the last 6 miles in. They come out every year for us, the neighborhood there in Spanish Hall, and they love it. The runners, we have a harmonica player from Key Biscayne, Florida, Louie. He stops off and plays a little blues jam with us every year. We look forward to him. He has his own crowd that shows up waiting for him to come. a former guitarist from California flies in. He runs the marathon, and we have a little amplifier and guitar for him. He stops in, plays a few songs with us, and continues back in the race. They look forward to what type of music the next mile has in store for them and everything. We'll never be able to run it, but we can play it.
If you make it to mile 21, you're going to finish the thing. I love watching after I finish. People just look horrible, and that's amazing to see. And like, but it's also great to see just how shocked people are that they were able to do this when they didn't know, and just how happy people are. Running is pretty boring. Like, the only thing that changes is it hurts a little more as time passes. And so, you know, to have something to break that up, even if it's the anticipation of music, like that you can hear in the distance, and then getting to the music, and then the music being gone and waiting for the next thing. Anything to change what's going on is good when what you're doing is running.
The strains of the Bishop Lachlan Memorial High School Band of Brooklyn, New York. Ian Chillog hopes to finish tomorrow's marathon in under 2 hours and 50 minutes. Everybody, sing along. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of our entire program at weekendamerica.org or at iTunes. Get out there and enjoy your weekend, everybody. Ration the candy. Be prudent. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
To beat your competitor, sometimes you have to innovate, even on the high school football field.
It doesn't matter to us whether they think that a trick play is coming, because yes, it is. On every play, something different is going to be coming at you.
I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, visit Piedmont High School's football team. 2 quarterbacks, 11 eligible receivers, complete pandemonium, and victories. Join us.